we ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, we are on. All right, welcome everybody. This is the Thursday, January 15th, Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting. And to start off with, we have Mr. John Beaton sitting in for Dean Benedix. I guess that's temporary, Mr. Beaton?
Or should be, yes.
Temporary.
Yes.
All right. He hopes so.
That's right.
And could you go ahead and call the roll, please?
Yes. Ms. Dean? Mr. Ehring?
Here.
Mr. Ashton? Mr. Costello? Mr. Gehring? Individuals cannot vote on any items. Their attendance doesn't count toward a quorum. Until appointed, they can attend for, I think, informational purposes, but they wouldn't be official members of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. If you have any nominations or any changes, Mr. Benedix asks that you get those into him as soon as you can, or to Doug Bird in the Public Works Department. They'll package those together and send them to the Board of Supervisors for approval. The County Administrative Office asks also that you include a short bio with the nominations. So. I also mentioned that minutes for the last meeting were not included in this packet. Mr. Benedix apologizes. He just hasn't had time to put those together. I anticipate that those will be in the next agenda packet. And also, I want to point out there is a typo on the of the agenda. Under item 5B, it says endorsement of CLO2 project. That should be endorsement of CO2 project. It's carbon dioxide, not chlorine dioxide. And then lastly, in the agenda packet, there's one page, a little spreadsheet that's labeled Zone 3 5-year CIP schedule. That really should be a draft schedule with the emphasis on draft right now. There's a number of things that aren't included in that, and they're still making changes. But
do you have a page number?
I do, possibly. It looks like maybe 4-3.
Thank you.
Okay,
that's it.
Thank you, Jeff. Are you
that's,
done?
That's all. Thank you.
And do you have any idea on the timing of getting the newly nominated delegates to the Board of Supervisors?
It takes a little time to prepare the paperwork for that and to get it on the board's agenda. I don't. I think if nominations could be sent in to Doug and Dean by the end of this month, possibly sometime in February they could go to the board. It usually takes, I think, they have to be on the agenda at least a week in advance, and it's got to go through some hands and such before it gets there. But I don't actually have an official date deadline for that.
Okay, and when the newly nominated delegates are actually appointed by the board, are you going to, or Mr. Benedix?
Benedix may ask for a little additional information, for the biography to go in with those, but he has their names.
Okay. Anything else on that item, Mr. Beaton?
No, thanks.
Just for clarification, Mr. Chairman, even if the people are elected and they're appointed by their respective council, they have to be approved by the Board of Supervisors, right?
That's right.
Yes. Really.
From CSA 12, the alternate, Chris Helenius, has resigned because he's moved to Napomo area. So CSA 12, Avila area, would probably suggest some nominations to the board, and the board would select that alternate at some point in the future.
Okay, thank you. Anyone have anything else on that issue before we move on? Okay, this is public comment. This is the time for anyone in the public who has an issue they wish to bring to the committee regarding something that is not on the agenda, and we'll go ahead and take whatever information you might have, and we'll consider it, but we won't be voting on it tonight. So please step forward and present whatever you may. Seeing none, and seeing none once again. All right, Mr. Benedix, it's time for the operations report.
Okay. Rainfall to date is 5.02 inches. Lake elevation is 498.24 feet. That provides 30,091 acre feet of storage, which is about 61% of the lake capacity. Downstream release is 4 MGD. Lopez plant production is 3 MGD. And we're taking delivery of about 1.2 MGD of state water. Water quality is good. Algae counts are low. Raw water odor is typical. The delivered water odors are low. Everything looks pretty good. I wanted to note that the last disinfection byproduct samples that were collected in November, the ones that we use for regulatory compliance, we've got results back on those. These samples are collected through the distribution system. The THMs averaged 20 parts per billion, and the haloacetic acids were 16 parts per billion. And those are excellent numbers. The limit is 80 parts per billion for trihalomethanes and 60 for haloacetic acids, averaged over a year's time. Before the plant upgrade, we would sometimes struggle to meet those THM limits, which in turn sodium hypochlorite, essentially a bleach solution, as their primary disinfectant. Sodium hypochlorite's very widely used. It's very effective, but it reacts readily with the organic matter we have in our water to form those THMs that we're just talking about. But again, generators is back on tonight. They're running. THMs from the plant look very good. Everything else looks good, too. That concludes my operations report.
All right. Questions for Mr. Beaton on that issue from anyone?
Don? No? No. Ted?
No.
No. I'm fine.
Yeah. And, John, THM's running 20 now, and what have they been running, or do we know what they run if we're not running chlorine dioxide?
If we go back to, say, before the plant upgrade, when we were using chlorine in the plant and chloramines in the distribution system, we could have values that were around 80 parts per billion, so, sometimes less than that, but they could go over it. I think you probably remember back many years ago, before we even had chloramines as a disinfectant, you could have values that were several hundred parts per billion out in the distribution system when we would just add chlorine to the water. Back at a time when we were more concerned about adequately disinfecting the water and didn't really know about some of those disinfection byproducts. So, more recently, I think if we don't use the chlorine dioxide in the plant, sometimes the plant itself can do pretty good and have THMs that are 50, 60 parts per billion, which would be acceptable down the distribution system. Other times, they can go up to 80, 90, and 100 parts per billion. Really depends on the organic content in the water and how good the treatment process is working. So,
okay, thank you. All right, did that raise any other questions in any members' minds?
Yeah, and just down at Avila, I recall that 5 years ago we were above 100 at some point in time.
Yes.
So it's really good to hear that we're down to the 20s.
I think Avila, Port San Luis, I think the result was 21 or 22.
Great. That's great.
Anybody else? Any questions? Now, for those in the audience, if you have a question, you're welcome to raise it. Just stick a hand in the air, and we'll go ahead and take it at any time. All right. I think we're to the plant upgrade completion issues, okay. Mr. Beaton.
Plant upgrade. Mr. Benedict's noted he would like to see that get done. I would bring your attention to two items. First is we're in the process of initiating what I'll call a sludge bed project. As you may recall, the plant removes particulate matter and other contaminants from the water during the treatment process. The dissolved air flotation, or the DAF unit, strips these particulates out by floating them up to the surface with tiny air bubbles. The resulting sludge is scraped off of the water surface and sent down to the sludge beds. Any remaining particulate matter is removed on the membrane filters when the water gets to them. And then that water and those contaminants are recycled back to the front of the plant where they are given another pass through the DAF unit and hopefully pulled off then. And that recycled water continues to come back to the front of the plant. The plant has two sludge beds. The sludge beds are really big sand filters. That sludge and particulate matter goes down there. It's trapped on the surface by the sand, and any water in that drains through and is collected in a sort of a French underdrain system there and then that water ultimately is discharged to the creek. They have two beds. One of them is typically active at any given time. The other one is not. The one that's not active, the sludge that's in there is typically drying out. When it gets dry enough to remove and haul off, that's what's done. It's taken to a landfill. But it has to be pretty dry. One of the problems we have right now is that this new plant is very effective at producing the sludge, removing all this particulate matter. And those two beds really don't provide sufficient capacity for handling the sludge. What we see happening is the active bed filling up with sludge before the other one is dry. So back when the original plant was designed, back in the 60s, they anticipated having four sludge beds down there. But unfortunately, over the years, only two of those were ever really fully developed and completed. So we're left with two. Mr. Benix is working with the firm of Kennedy Jenks to formulate a current solution. And this could involve designing additional beds or redesigning the existing beds, coming up with some way of handling that sludge. We're also looking very closely at any of the waste streams, I'll call it, that are generated at the plant. There are times when there's been some change in the plant, or we're just starting up where beds, they wouldn't have to handle it as much. So those that project is one that Dean would like to work on and get started now. This is pretty much a simple description. There really are a lot of other issues associated with the sludge beds and what we would need to do down there. Other completion issues, I'll mention this carbon dioxide project later under new business. And at that time, seek your endorsement for that project. Mr. Benedix notes that we're still awaiting Paul's performance test results or test report. I have not received that. Paul Corporation, the manufacturer of the membranes, has not been paid all their money yet. There's still some closeout issues. There's some piping and such that they anticipate replacing and some other items. I believe we're still negotiating with Paul on about $600,000 of remaining in their contract. But things are proceeding. They are continuing to make changes in the plant and continue to optimize things and tweak it to make things work. So.
And funding is from the existing revolving fund loan?
Correct.
Okay.
Questions?
Mr. Waltz.
John, how much money do we have left in the balance of that loan?
I don't know.
We're getting pretty close, aren't we?
I believe so. I know in the past he's reported on, I think if you were to take all the things we'd really like to do and how much you'd estimate those would cost, there wouldn't be enough money in the revolving fund to fully pay for those.
But the loan closes out fairly soon, does it not?
You know, I know they extended that, but for some reason, July or something sounds, you know, I think they got a one-year extension on that. It had an earlier date that everything was supposed to be completed by, but I honestly, I don't know for certain.
Well, maybe Jennifer will brief us on that at budget time.
It's
here,
possible.
The next month or so.
Except that I'll mention later, Jennifer has gone to another department now.
Oh, my God. So, as I recall, he didn't have enough money to finish the fencing.
That's true.
Yeah, so.
A number of these projects, yeah. You know, Dean is, I think, the best of his ability trying to shuffle monies around. And
No, I think, you know, with all that we've done out there and the way we've worked the money around, and Dean has worked the money around, I think we've done a good job on it, or he's done a good job on it.
Yeah, I agree.
There are projects that we'd like to have finished out there, but the most important one is to have clean water.
Any other comments? And Mr. Beaton, these items have been fully vetted for the Technical Advisory Committee?
I believe so.
That's my recollection.
It's, and that they tend to support these
projects.
As I
recall, it was a unanimous support.
The sludge bed, proceeding with that project, I think will be helpful in the plant, being able to manage that, keep us from exceeding any of our discharge limits. Last thing we want to do is pollute Arroyo Grande Creek. Handling that sludge is problematic. They do the best they can, but they just don't have enough time for an individual bed to dry out. With four beds, a bed might only be on for 3 months, and then it'd have, another 9 months to dry out before we'd have to use it again.
How close have they been on running the beds over here with the new facility in operation?
If you went out there today, they fill up with sludge, and it takes a while. The sludge, it has a tendency to really hold on to the water to dry. We've been fortunate in the sense that we've had a lot of dry, hot weather, which accelerates that process. But I guess the last thing I would hope for is not much rain. But that does compound the drying of those beds. More recently, they've been able to, when the bed gets dry enough to haul it out, but not dry enough to dispose of in a landfill, they've scraped it out and spread it out on an area below the terminal dam there, and they've got hay bales to kind of hold it in there, but it gives them another spot to allow that to dry a little longer till it meets the requirements for the landfill for the amount of moisture and such it has in it. So it's a bit of a shell game down there, moving things around to keep up with it.
Didn't we have a problem last year where there was a break or something in that, and we polluted the creek?
There was last year, or I guess it's about almost 2 years ago now. Yeah.
Had the whole year in there.
You missed a year.
Wells might be too high in the sludge to dispose of, but we were lucky there and able to dispose of that without having to haul it off to a hazardous waste facility.
Okay, thank you for that. Did those comments raise any questions in anybody's mind that hadn't had a chance to ask any questions? How about in the audience? No questions? I don't see any hands in the air. All right, so it looks like you might be filling in for Jennifer Colbert.
I will do my best here.
All right.
Unfortunately, Ms. Colbert informed me that the draft 08-09 budget was not ready for distribution tonight. So maybe that's why she's not here. Pablo Ogren, the Public Works Director, wanted to clarify and improve some of the budget detail. In particular, he wants to see the budget detail normal operations from special projects. So they're working to finalize that. That clarified budget or enhanced budget will be distributed to the individual Zone 3 member agencies' finance committees when the Public Works Department meets with them in February, and that'll be before the next Zone 3 meeting. So they will have the final proposed budget, and I imagine that we'll be able to distribute that at one of the TAC meetings and bring it to this meeting in March.
And then that goes to the Board of Supervisors in June?
I believe so, yes. Mr. Benedict and Ms. Colvard also noted that we are still within the five-year projections. They have the budget projections that they formulate. And I will clarify again that the one item that's in the table that's included in the agenda packet that says it's a five-year CIP schedule, there are a lot of changes that still need to be made on that, so I wouldn't look too closely at it. I think he included that in there just to show how he wanted to move some of the things around to help pay for that carbon dioxide project. But numbers don't all add up. There are items that aren't included in there that's still being worked on. As I mentioned, Ms. Colbert has accepted a promotion in our county's general services department. And at this point in time, I don't know who will take over that position. I could hope that maybe Straith or someone who's done this before could, but I don't know. It may be someone new again.
So. Okay, thank you for that. Any comments or questions on the budget that we don't have yet?
And the HCP are in compliance with the fish attraction schedule. They don't expect that revision of the HCP to be a big deal or a big work effort. We'll then submit that final draft HCP, if you will, to all the resource agencies. Those include the National Marine Fisheries, the California Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the State Water Resources Control Board, who manages the water rights permit. So things are progressing there, but it's not done yet.
Five more years?
I hope not.
We are somewhere around $1 million and somewhere around 10 years. In round numbers and round years.
Yes.
Okay. Questions?
Does it do any good to ask a question?
Yes, please.
We're still going along. My only comment is that it seems impossible to me. I'm going to take.
Question and comments all have deaf ears.
Yeah, deaf ears. Doesn't matter.
I have a comment, Jim.
Yes, Mr. Wallace.
John, I noticed that in the report on the spillway project that there's a potential for that project to affect the HCP. Can you elaborate on that as to what impact it might have on the schedule or the types of things that might be required to go into the HCP? I don't know if it's appropriate now or later on.
Yeah, it's I too feel like it could have some impacts. I think honestly Dean or Doug would be best able to identify what those impacts would be, but you know, if you start holding more water behind the dam, you know, I can imagine there would be some agencies that would want to take advantage of that or want you to release more water down the stream. With that increase in the dam, we would have to go and I think amend the water rights permit to be able to store more water and divert that to the cities. So there's a lot of complications. I would hope that you'd really hope that you wouldn't have to do an entirely new HCP afterwards.
And in the meanwhile, we still have our interim downstream release schedule in force if it rains. So we do have something to capture rainfall if it does rain.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions?
Jim, for the new person, what does HCP stand for? I'm here.
Habitat Conservation Plan.
Say again?
All right. Did that raise any more comments or questions?
Just a snide remark.
And I don't see anybody sticking a hand up in the audience. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
You know, for what we went through with the retrofit the last time, where we were doing things, I would just imagine as soon as we put in for a permit to do something up there again, to raise the dam or whatever, well, that's going to open up a whole new bunch of regulations and we're going to have to spend a lot of money on more studies. And you know how much we spent on studies before we got to the dam retrofit to begin with, along with all the rest of the things. So.
Well, you're quite right. Although, just keep in mind that a large portion of the project costs are for those studies.
Well, true. But, you know, us water users got to pay it somewhere at some time, regardless of what part they go to. Sir.
True. All right, did Mr. Reynolds' comments raise any other issues? If not, we'll move on to quagga mussel update.
Okay. Their summary inspection reports are included in the agenda packet. Good news is that no mussels have been found so far. My lab staff is continuing to work closely with the California's invasive species specialist. He's come to our laboratory. We've allowed him to use our facilities there to do some work. In return, he's provided us with some training on recognition and identification of these mussel larvae and villagers. We actually sent some staff up to San Justo so they could see what's happening up there. We continue to look at a number of monitoring devices, if you will, that we've installed in Lopez Lake, Lopez Terminal, Salinas Reservoir, Lake Nacimiento. From what the invasive species expert tells us, our waters here are just like perfect for those mussels, you know, with the hardness and the calcium content and such. We would actually be one of the, I guess, most at risk, you know, if these things got in there. And the thing that saves us is that we tend to be a little bit more isolated. We're not hooked up with the, you know, state water projects, such where these things are confluent with a number of reservoirs in the south, but it's a concern. Our Parks Department is doing a great job of inspecting every boat that comes into Santa Margarita or Lopez Lake. They just turn you around. For the local people that use the lake often, they do have a program where they can attach a little wire between your boat and the trailer so that when you come back in, you know, if that little wire is still attached, you don't have to go through that process again. They know you haven't disconnected your boat from the trailer, and you should still be good. So a lot of the local people, I think, take advantage of that. So you know, there's a number of returning visitors, and so that's worked out well for them. Nacimiento continues to be a concern, and that's again a reservoir for which you know, we don't have as much control. Monterey County works on that, but you know, we do the best we can. We are working with people up there to do inspections of monitoring sites, but as far as inspecting boats and such, I think all they've done up there is post advisories to the people, warning them of this problem. So, as you recall, Dennis Delzite is working on our invasive response plan. We're required to put one of those together so that if we do get mussels here, this is what we plan to do. So he's helping to formulate that. I think Cal Poly is also available to help him with it, as is the City of San Luis Obispo. They provided some funding for that, and that work is continuing. They had a meeting, I think, at the courthouse a week or two ago. I have a particular woman, a chemist on my staff, that's working very closely with that, and she's actually compiling information and talking to all these people. So we're pretty set up to see if they're there, but you know, obviously the next step is what are we going to do if they get in. And again, I'm very thankful to the Parks Department for their efforts to try to keep them out. That's the best thing for us right now. So,
all right, thank you. Questions?
Yeah,
Mr.
I'm wondering, is there anything that we can do, say in Monterey County? Is there any pressure that we can bring to bear anyway? You know, to get them to begin to conform to the same kind of a system that we use here?
It's complicated. You know, I believe we do have people that are going to our board of supervisors, or our board of supervisors is going to their counterparts in Monterey County to try to convince them to do more and apply some pressure. You know, some people have said, gosh, you know, the state of California should come in and apply pressure, and they just haven't been effective at making, you know, like here, they have certain roads, you know, isolated roads that go into there. And if you were to set up some sort of a check station there, you might be able to, you know, to keep people out. But you can just can imagine what that would be like, having to staff that 24 hours a day, you know, and somebody there doing inspections. It's tough. I think, the thing that saves us there are being a little bit isolated. So if you've come from a place that's contaminated and you're driving down the highway, there's a good chance that a lot of that stuff is going to dry out, you know. But it's a risk. It's a very real risk up there. We have that Nacimiento project, and we're very concerned about that. They've made some modifications to that project in anticipation of, you know, the potential mussels coming in, as far as gratings and things, being able to have extras that they can pull the existing grating out, put another one in, clean this one out, and kind of go through that process. We're hoping that I think Dennis Delzite will have some insights as to what we can do if we get them there. There are you know, a number of people that are studying to see if there is something that can be done to eradicate these, but boy, you know, they certainly haven't been successful in other places. That's so.
Are these sites that we have listed in this report, are they just certain? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sites in Nacimiento. Are they just the sites that are available there that are monitoring or doing something? There are these other sites. I mean, you can get in quite a few spots, sure, up there. Sure. I mean, and people do.
We've done the best.
Rather than use the ramp.
we've done the best that we can in working with some of the people up there, and they've been, a number of people have been cooperative, where we've been able to go out to a place where there's a boat dock or a boat launching facility, hang one of these devices. It's very simple, you know, even if you just put a construction brick or something in the water, that, you know, that would suffice, but we put those there. There's a program to go in and check those basically once a month. My understanding is that if these villagers or these mussels get in there and then they start to reproduce, they grow very fast. You know, so you know, there was a concern earlier on about being able to identify the little microscopic ones, and it's, you know, you don't have to worry about that. If you've got them in there, you know, within a month's time, they're going to be readily visible. In 2 months' time, they're going to be huge. So Monterey County has, I think, continually told us that they just don't have any money to do this. So it's a very frustrating situation.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Mr. Myers, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah. John, how long can these critters live outside the water at X temperature? Give select a temperature that's reasonable, let's say 70 degrees. How long can they live outside the water? Do we know?
It can be several days.
Several days, really.
Yeah, I think the mussels can close up. You know, I think there's a lot of things to, you know, that can affect that, the temperature outside. Yeah. So if it's very hot and things, that it's going to be less. But
So having a boat that doesn't have water doesn't mean that it's free of contaminants, does it?
Not necessarily. And that's, again, on our system, our lakes here, the parks people go around and they actually inspect. They go around and look at it. They'll look at the trailer, because you can imagine you can back a trailer up.
Oh,
and
yeah, sure.
And, you know, and if there's water in the taillight or anything like that, then they say, nope, you can't bring it in.
But that's really not a true test if they can live days outside the water.
It's, again, you know, they're looking for...
At the best, it's just sort of a guessing, by golly.
I think, again, if they're the little villagers, the little microscopic ones, they're probably not going to live as long as, say, an adult mussel.
Sure.
And so one of the things they'll look for on the boat is if... there's evidence on there that the boat has been sitting in some water for a long time. So you've got some kind of incrustation and such on there that's been there for a while. They'll say, nope, we don't want that in here. You need to clean that off. They have the high-pressure hose. So after, if it's a new boat or one that hasn't been there before, they've gone around and done the inspection, they'll use this hot water pressure wash regardless. They don't look at it and say, well, it looks clean, so you can just go in. They go through the whole cleaning process.
That was my next question. Yeah. At what temperature can you kill them, with the steam or high pressure or
they,
water?
Yeah, it's the pressure washers they have are use this heated water. I don't remember the exact temperature.
Yeah.
But
140.
But that's enough to kill the little critters?
Supposedly, yes.
Supposedly.
Yeah. It's better than nothing, but it's
probably nothing, right?
Yeah. They worry about places, in the boat where you could have a bait well or something, whether it's water, and the things could live a long time in those areas.
So. Yeah, we old boaters know where the hidden places are. You have to clean them out sometimes. It's tough.
John, do you know when they start to bring the water, when that pipeline is done for drinking water, bringing out a Nacimiento? Will there be
a rock reservoir or Salinas reservoir or something? But
it would be a problem if they ever got these mussels up there and they came down through that system. And
it's a concern, and I think that's one of the reasons that coming up with this response plan. What they could try to do is keep them out of the pipeline, because obviously that causes problems. But I believe they designed for some chemical addition, some pigging processes and such to try to. Let's say they got into that pipe to be able to disinfect that, you know, and kill those mussels. But it's tough, you know. Everything I read back east, it's a horrendous problem for them.
John, have there been any of those mussels found in the state system down this far yet?
North of us in San Justo, I think they've got, I want to say, zebra mussels that they have in that reservoir, and it's packed. I think the state closed it down. They don't allow people in there at all now. South of us, I think, as you get down toward San Diego. And
no, but I mean the water coming down the state system, has ever been, have they found any in that?
They have.
In the pipeline?
I couldn't say for certain, but I think in the Colorado River, they found them there. And then where that water is piped out to these other reservoirs, they found them in those reservoirs, and they believe that that's the path that they've taken. So it is a problem south of us.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Questions? Nobody in the audience? All right. I guess we are to the spillway capacity increase concept.
Okay.
And you're still on, John.
At the last Zone 3 meeting, you requested Mr. Benedict prepare a summary document. That document is included in the agenda packet.
That's the January 7th, 2009 letter.
Let's see, I believe. Just double check here. That's correct.
2-1.
Mr. Benedict noted to me that there was a question of whether we can get a water rights permit amendment for additional storage and diversion to the cities. Jan Goldsmith has been asked to answer that question. Obviously, if the answer is no, then we wouldn't be able to proceed. It wouldn't make any sense to proceed with this project. And Mr. Benedict also cautioned that we would not want to have any adverse impacts on the groundwater. Mr. Benedict would like to add the first two components of the spillway project, which are estimated to cost $70,000 and $160,000, to the 2009-10 budget. Mr. Benedict asks that the member agencies be ready to voice their commitment for participation at the March 3rd meeting. So I believe the intention was to provide this letter to you. You can take back to your agencies and decide whether you would want to proceed with this.
John,
yes.
Could I just for a second, the March 3rd meeting?
I'm sorry, I said
March 19th, maybe?
March 19th, yes, so the March meeting.
March 19th, then.
I'm going to go to the technical committee first, though, isn't it?
I would imagine, certainly, that the technical committee would look at that. I think we did present this to the technical committee the last time, and they unanimously endorsed this project. As you know, Zone 3, again, is an advisory committee, and they can recommend the project, but ultimately the Board of Supervisors would make the final determination on proceeding or not. Mr. Benedict also noted that this time he just simply doesn't have the staff to manage and yet another project. And I understand there may be a possibility that one of the Zone 3 agencies, like Arroyo Grande, could possibly take the lead on this, and we'd work with them. But, Dean, every time you turn around, he's lost another engineer or another person. It's just really hard to manage all of these projects for him.
From a process standpoint, I'm not sure I'm clear on it. This January 7th letter asks that each of the prospective contractors take the issue back to their advisory body and get approval of adding the $70,000 plus the $160,000 to the budget. Is that right?
I would say that's probably correct. I think would ask that you would go back to your agencies and see if this is a project you would like to have done.
So each board or council would have a presentation made,
yes,
with regard to this item.
Yes, and then come back and say, yes, we want to proceed. Honestly, I couldn't tell you how that's actually funded then, if because it's a Type 3 project, if they each of these different agencies would have to put that money up, or if that's something that could be funded out of the Zone 3 budget directly. Honestly, I don't know, and unfortunately...
Is that something that we could get an answer back before the March 19th?
I will certainly pass that on to Dean, and hopefully he could just email you an answer.
One time we talked about taking that out of reserves.
Yes.
And is that still the case or not? That would be a question. I think it'd be important to know that.
Yes.
And another thing along with that, if one of the agencies didn't want to participate in that, well, then their share of the reserves wouldn't be used for that, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. Without that, that would be another question we'd
yes.
like to answer on.
How would that actually manage? Yes.
that would be a little complicated on how to split up those reserves because they're not presently allocated to any particular agency. Yeah.
It may be that you'd have to come back, and if you want to do this project, you'd have to provide that funding directly. And I think Dean again has estimated that to go to the next two stages of this, they'd need the $70,000 and the $160,000.
See, I think it's going to be difficult to go to the city councils and boards without knowing how that's going to function.
It definitely will be, no doubt.
It will.
Absolutely.
Well, because I kind of get the feeling that Pismo Beach probably go along with it, at least for the study. I think it'd be foolish for any agency. Of course, that's.
But you'd need to. We'd need to know.
You need to know. Yes. And what would it be, a percentage based on the amount that you're allocated?
I would think so.
Okay.
But I'll present that question to Dean and ask that he get back to the different agencies.
Mr. Wallace, you look like you had a question.
You know, just a couple questions there, John. As I recall from the TAC meeting previously, the water rights issue was paramount. And if Jan Goldsmith comes back with a negative at the next TAC meeting, which I believe is what, the March 3rd or so?
Or memory, yes.
Then the project has a real problem at this point.
Yes.
And there may be issues that she brings up that need further research or further discussion as well.
Yes.
So I'm not sure if we're going to have a real clear answer by the time that you need to put it in the budget, but perhaps it could be put in the budget as a contingency item. And the other point was our discussion about the estimate of the cost, because part of that was for concept formulation and benefit assessment, and then alternatives in an engineering feasibility study. And I think that we were asking the question, why can't we jump to the alternatives assessment engineering feasibility study without spending $70,000 on concept formulation and so forth?
Okay.
It seems to be something that we've pretty well talked about so far. And with further information from the state DSOD on the feasibility from their point of view as to whether or not we could actually raise a dam, and what might be entailed there with the retention of the existing freeboard as well as strengthening of the abutments, that would be critical, I think, and also to proceed from here.
Okay.
Dwayne.
In reading the staff report,
do you have the button, please?
Up to the microphone, please.
Yeah, we've got to have you on record.
Raise your hand.
Get him in his jogging outfit.
Just raise your hand.
No, just raise your hand.
Then you can
cover
the
podium.
Okay.
All right. Sorry, I didn't make that clear.
Okay.
In reading the report, I noticed that there was no discussion about treatment or any additional costs associated with treatment if this watershed, because it's it comes in a rather relatively short period of time, because there's quite a few dry years. And has there been any discussion if we were able to generate the water, could the existing facilities treat it, and could we deliver it?
Certainly that would be a question. It wouldn't make sense to spend all this money to store water that you wouldn't be able to treat. The existing plant does have some ability to expand the capacity. I think up to 6.7 MGD. Some of those membrane racks there are not fully fit.
And I guess just to try to figure out the extent of what the water is going to cost before we move forward, you'd have to, I would think, include those costs and what the cost of the project or the water is going to be. And that would make it a lot easier for the agencies to decide whether they want to move forward or at least a ballpark estimate on treatment and delivery.
Well, I think you're right. I think that would be included in the 160K study.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So where do we stand here? I'm a little bit at sea as to where we are. Maybe you can help us, Mr. Wallace.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Perrault.
Yes. If I could, just for a second, Bob Perrault, City Manager, Grover Beach. Just to kind of reiterate, I think it's really important that we get an idea in terms of whether we are going to be able to use those reserves or not before we can take this back to our councils. And in order to keep this, I know that this is a five-year program, but obviously water is very important to us, so we need to get started as quickly as possible. If we could have that information sometime during the month of February so we can get to our councils and boards in time to be able to get back here by the 19th, I think that would be important, 19th of March. The other thing is I'd really like to get some clarification, probably not at this meeting, but need to have some clarification as to the timing of these studies. If we are in fact going to be asked to come up with these dollars, is it going to be necessary, to come up with, is it all at once? Can we spread it between a couple of fiscal years? That sort of thing, I think would be important answers to those questions to get. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
No, thank you. Anybody else? Mr. Myers.
Yeah, as a new kid on the block, I have a couple of basic issues I don't know anything about. I am led to believe when I read in the papers that the reservoir has never been full. If it has, it's only been full once or twice in the last 10, 12 years. And if I'm correct in that, we normally run 60, 70% of capacity. I ask the question, why do we need to have more capacity that we can't fill out what we already got? You have an answer for that? Or am I wrong, right, or am I off target? Or what's the story there?
Well, I have an answer for that.
Okay,
Mr. Myers.
Sure.
Let me pass on. Do we have an overhead? Is that thing working?
Looks like it. Yes.
I knew Jim would have an answer. He always got an answer. Thank you, Jim.
That's part of the report that was prepared for the committee by URS. I can see that it's kind of hard to read, unfortunately. However, this line that I'm pointing to is the dam full line. Okay. And this is the 5-foot rise line.
Uh-huh.
The blue line is the water surface projected by URS over the lifespan of the reservoir to date, but to date being about 2005. So as you look at this chart, you can see that if you count those peaks, that the reservoir would have filled to the 5-foot level 11 separate times.
That's good to hear. I didn't know that. It wasn't in the report, and I didn't know what the answer was. That's good news.
Hey, did you have another question?
No, the second question was dependent on what the answer to the first question was, and you've already exploded my thunder, so thank you, Jeff.
Well, there is a problem, of course, and that is that this period between, I can't read the date, 1987, and I think that's about 1996. So there's an 11-year period there that, as you can see, the dam did not fill.
Yes.
And so if this program does go into effect, we're going to have to learn and see how to manage those dry periods differently than perhaps we do now.
Well, I did have one more question that it's kind of anticlimactic, but if we need the extra 5 feet, and we did the retrofit a few years ago. Was that considered in whether to put these gates in or to raise the spillway, or was it just something wasn't we couldn't need or didn't have the funding for or whatever?
That extra 5 feet was not part of the retrofit consideration, and it would be part of the new study.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Anybody else help me out on those answers? Welcome to try to help me out, Mr. Wallace. Really.
No, that's correct. I was going to say the original studies for the stability did not include the concept of raising the spillway. One of the things that's kind of come to light as we've talked about this, these gates are collapsible. So in large storms, if the reservoir is full with the gates up and we had a large prediction of a large storm coming in, they could be collapsed and let the water out so that we would still have the capacity of the dam. The state dams regulatory agency has said, regardless, we want you to raise the entire length of the dam across the whole length of the dam to keep the same amount of freeboard that we have now. which is an expensive proposition. So we don't quite have a good estimate on it, but they were talking about $4.5 million, which seems to me to be low, especially when you're considering some of the abutment problems that we would have there. The other point somebody was making about, well, I think maybe Duane was saying, do we treat all this water at one time? And no, because you don't have the water until the reservoir fills at the new level.
True.
And once that does fill the new level, it's not treated and discharged all at one time. It's kind of factored into the draw year by year by year. And so it's just another little increment on top of what we're taking now. So you would theoretically, once the reservoir fills, you would have that extra capacity to deal with or to accommodate additional safe yield over that period of time. And then, of course, it has to fill up again to take advantage of the next cycle.
It is a complicated issue, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. Yeah. All right. More so than it appears at the surface, right?
We've dealt with a consultant, and Jim was on the conference call with me, with the consultant, asking about how to reconcile this safe yield issue. And I don't think we really have a final answer on what the safe yield would be for each incremental rise in the reservoir.
From my perspective, when you add these fill peaks up, each one of them representing a 5-foot rise, and in the URS report they give you the value of the amount of water that is stored each time. Over that 35-year period, there's about 55,000 acre-feet of water that gets stored that wouldn't otherwise be stored. So it does look like there would be a substantial increase in safe yield, although we're left with managing this dry period. And there may be a way to do that through conjunctively using the groundwater and the reservoir.
Okay. Question, sir.
Yes, sir.
I don't recall the dam spilling in the year 2000. Has it spilled since then? You know, because you got it showing up there that it's over 5 feet up there in that one from 95 to 2000 and whatnot, and we haven't had that much rain up there. So doesn't that kind of make all the numbers askew a little bit?
I think those are projections, and I can't answer your question. I'd have to have the URS answer that.
That's kind of like cloud seeding, maybe?
No.
I got to dig these guys about that cloud seeding.
That made a lot of water.
Anyone else? Any
new issues arising? Anybody in the audience? So what we need here, Mr. Beaton, is a... perhaps a voice vote to take this back to our respective advisory bodies, or at least just the advice that we need to do that.
I think Dean is just asking you to take that back to your bodies. I'll ask him to provide additional clarification on how the funding and such would take place. But you know, I guess ideally, if you came back. If you had all those answers and came back on the March advisory committee meeting and were prepared to make a commitment at that time or voice your commitment one way or the other, I think would be helpful to him.
And knowing Mr. Peralta as well as I do, I'm wondering if we can get a response on the issue of the reserves by February.
I'll ask the question.
Okay.
You know, that reserve deal could be the thing that sold the whole monkey wrench in person.
It could.
Be nice to have that answer on the reserves at our TAC meeting in February.
Yes. So did that exchange raise any other issues that anybody would like to ask? Anybody in the audience? No?
Jim, would it be necessary for us to have a meeting earlier than... If this information gets to the TAC in February, and we don't really have a meeting in February at all, and anything in the early part of March, I'm concerned that the information doesn't get to us.
I guess what we could do is if the TAC comes to some agreement on recommending a course of action to the committee, we could have a special meeting to deal with
that. I would
that.
Imagine that it could be done, yes. You could call
and
for a special meeting.
A special meeting in February.
Right? Yeah, but this whole thing isn't going to move that fast.
Well, I can think of at least two city managers that would like it to move that fast. Any other issues on that item? Anybody got anything they'd like to add? Okay. I think we are to new business and the 2009 meeting schedule.
The 2009 meeting schedule was included in the agenda packet.
Page 3-1.
3-1.
There it is.
Maybe I jumped the gun.
Is there a...
I said, I guess maybe I jumped the gun because this was exactly what, you know, I was concerned about, okay, that we weren't having a meeting.
What did you want to do with this, John? It's just information?
Just information. We're passing that on to you.
Anyone have any issues arise upon first glance? If not, we'll...
pretty much standard format.
It is. If not, we'll move on then. Okay. Everybody's advised of the meeting schedule. And and the chlorine project.
Or the
chlorine
CO2.
The carbon dioxide.
Carbon
project.
Dioxide project.
All right.
Yes.
CO2.
Correct. I think we all know that water from Lopez project is hard. It's very hard. Hard water can have a tendency to form scale deposits. Given time or if severe, those scale deposits can become a real problem. The deposits can reduce or even stop flow in the pipes. It can form on the membranes, resulting in the need for more frequent and aggressive cleaning. Small pieces of this the scale can break off and form turbidity in the water, which can then be a regulatory compliance issue for us. It can form on valve surfaces, preventing the valves from fully closing. I think at the last TAC meeting, Dean brought in a valve to show how this the scale can really be problematic in the system. Unfortunately, at the Lopez plant, we've seen all of these effects. One way to address the problem is to soften the water. Unfortunately, all the softening options we've looked at in the past have been prohibitively expensive. Sludge generated by a softening process can be orders of magnitude greater than what we see right now, and handling that sludge and disposing of that sludge is problematic as well. Another way to address the problem is to reduce the scaling tendency of the water. The single factor having the greatest effect on scaling tendency is the pH of the water. There are other things that do affect it, but I think pH is probably the biggest factor. The higher the pH, the greater the tendency of that hard water to form scale. What we'd like to do is reduce the pH of the water, and this can be done by adding acid to the water, or another maybe more preferable way of adjusting the pH would be by using carbon dioxide. The addition of carbon dioxide for pH adjustment was recommended in the Kennedy-Jenks report, and is supported by the Public Works staff. Mr. Benedix has outlined a means of funding a CO2 project in his attachment here. Again, diverting some monies from maybe projects of a lower priority to this. He's indicated this is probably one of his top priorities for new things going on at the plant there. And what he would ask is for your endorsement of proceeding with the CO2 project tonight. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Okay, and I don't have anything. Anybody else? Anybody have anything? Mr. Wallace.
Just one question, John. At the TAC meeting, we talked about maybe determining, if we could, better as to what the constituency of the material was that was coating the pipes, and whether or not a pH reduction would be effective in controlling that.
I can mention that that particular valve that we saw there with that coating inside, that coating looks identical to other coatings we've seen in the membrane section of the plant there, that when they've had problems with turbidometers and things, we've opened it up and we found that in those deposits. We analyzed those deposits and they were predominantly calcium, so I think it's a calcium hardness, which is what you would predict from, okay, from this water. So, again, it was different than the kinds of deposits we've seen down the distribution line in the past when we've done the pigging there. But this is just a very hard calcium scale on the inside of the pipes. As the Kennedy Jenks report noted, one of the measures of scaling tendency is a Langelier index. It's one of several different indicators. If you plug the numbers in, you'll find for our water that it is very hard. They believe that if you were to lower the pH somewhat, that you would reduce that scaling tendency. And they thought that maybe reducing the pH down to a neighborhood of, say, 7.5, something like that, would have a significant effect. I've put together charts for the operators that show kind of a, if you will, kind of a sweet zone for pH versus temperature for a lot of different areas or different temperatures and pHs. And you can see it really does show up that when it's in the summertime and it's hot out and the pH is high, has a tremendous tendency for the water to scale out. Other times of the year, that wouldn't necessarily be the case, but reducing the pH of the water a little bit can make a big difference. We need to talk with the California Department of Public Health, because this kind of a change would involve amending our operating permit. I think they're amenable to that, but they want to make sure that we do this carefully so that in trying to solve one problem at the Lopez plant, we don't create other problems for the downstream users as far as lead and copper corrosion, that type of thing. But again, I've also compiled data, historical data, and you can see that, yes, it the scaling tendency is high now. It's been that high in the past. Back in the 90s, there was a period of time, there seems to be some cyclic nature to it. It may be related to rainfall, such again, too, and when the dam fills up and you got more, you know, rainwater and such in there, and there's maybe a less tendency for that scaling. As you go through years of drought and things tend to concentrate a little bit more, it could increase it, that tendency. But again, Dean has indicated this is probably one of his top priorities of projects he'd like to get done, and would certainly entertain an endorsement from the Zone 3 Advisory Committee.
And we had unanimous concurrence at Technical Advisory Committee level.
Yes.
So, questions? This is Dean.
I'm not a member of the TAC.
Is your marketing role, ma'am?
Yes, let's try it this way. Since I'm not a member of the TAC, could you describe how this will be done in the plant?
You can push the button.
There's a little button you can push there.
The button, no?
Is there a light?
It looks like it's the green lights on.
Oh. Yeah, the green lights
on. Just pull it closer. Okay.
Okay. Oh, I can hear it now. Yeah. Since I'm not a member of the TAC and wasn't privileged to kind of listen in, and I'm not a really technical person, can you kind of describe how that's going to work on operate in the at the water treatment plant?
What they would do is bring in a big cylinder. I think, Jim, you've got one like this down at Lompoc.
Yes.
A big cylinder is full of liquid carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
The plumbed in so that we could take some, if you will, carrying water, a side stream of water that would go by this tank, and we'd pull out a little bit of this carbon dioxide solution and mix with that water, and it would create kind of an acidic water, and then that in turn would be blended back in with the main stream of water in the plant. We would have to pick the optimal location for doing that. It may be a point in the mid-treatment process. It could be something after the chlorine dioxide contact chamber, before it goes to the membranes. or we might find that it would be best to do this at the front of the plant, that we could improve the treatment processes and such there. Kennedy Jenks indicated that they might have had a little concern that if we lower the pH, that the chlorine dioxide might be less effective. But honestly, I don't think we'll be changing the pH that much to really adversely impact that process. Putting the pH adjustment at the front of the plant may help to prevent any scaling tendencies that might be occurring in the flocculators or in any of the piping and in the dissolved air flotation and such in the front of the plant. But most of the scaling we've seen so far, though, has been at the back end after you come through this chlorine dioxide contact chamber and we go into the big pumps that pump that water in through the membranes. And right at that point in time, there's a stainless steel filter, if you will, that the water goes through that prevents, keeps any large particles and things from going onto the membranes and rupturing those. And we've seen those filters just entirely plug up with the scale. What we have to do right now is come in with a crane, lift the top of these pumps off, get in there, clean that stuff out with acid, put it back together, and go on. It's a real challenge. So we're hoping that this would prevent that from happening, or at least slow that process down so that instead of having to do this every several months, you might have to do it every several years.
So you're treating all of the water that's coming through?
That would be correct, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Now, it's costing, what is this cost? $31,000 a year in chemicals additional?
I think that was his estimate that for the carbon dioxide, you would, I think you can go to vendors and have them provide equipment and such, but the cost for that carbon dioxide, Kennedy Jenks has estimated, would be, you know, so much a pound, and you would need this many pounds to treat. We'd certainly have to determine what that cost would be, but they estimate something like $30,000 a year. Using another acid like sulfuric acid might be a couple thousand dollars less expensive. But sulfuric acid brings it a whole host of issues with that from a safety standpoint and, you know, storage and everything. It's probably worth it to spend a few dollars more for carbon dioxide and not have to deal with all those other issues.
Is it a possibility that by adding this, you would have less chemical use in cleaning the pol membranes themselves?
Absolutely.
Then there would be offsets that way, and it might not cost as much as what it says here then.
It can have impacts all the way down the process, you know, where, as you say, prevent some of that scaling from occurring on the membranes. We don't have to go through the CIPs as often. That means we're not having to deal with those chemicals and neutralizing those chemicals and sending those down to the sludge beds. It could have a number of benefits. We'd also look to see what's happening down our distribution line, you know, over time. And there's a possibility that that might be slightly reduced, and the need for pigging, you know, could be reduced. So.
And everybody would have softer water.
It actually wouldn't be any softer. They'd still have the same amount of that calcium and magnesium hardness in there. But as it goes through the plant and we would have adjusted the pH, so there'd be less of a tendency for that to actually scale out, attach itself to the sides of the...
Would it scale in our homes as much, do you think?
You know, it's hard to say.
Okay.
When I've looked at this index on the distribution line, the numbers have been less down the distribution system than they have been, at the front end of the plant. So... It certainly is not going to have the same impact that softening the water would.
Okay.
A lot of people, you know, certainly would like to do that, and we certainly would like to do that. It has a lot of advantages, but it's terribly expensive.
Yeah, it looked like other options would do that kind of thing, but...
There was, I think Kennedy Jenks had a proposal for a pellet softener that, but again, instead of $600,000, really, you're talking about, you know, $8 million or so.
And Mr. Reynolds has been pestering me for a chance.
John, how long does it take them to take one of those membrane units apart, clean it, and put it back together?
They won't take it apart, but they'll take it offline and close certain valves and such and run these chemicals through it. That process, there's actually three different cleaning processes that go through. There's one process which is basically just what they call a reverse flow air scour, where they just run clean water backwards through that and push off all that stuff that's kind of coating the outside of the membranes, and then they bubble air through it to kind of shake the membranes and loosen up all that stuff, and then they dump that back out to the front of the plant. That happens all the time, and, you know, every so many minutes it'll go through those processes. Less often they'll do what they call an enhanced flux maintenance. Flux is a measure of how easy the water or how hard it is to get it through those membranes. And they'll go through a cleaning process there where they'll use things like sodium hypochlorite, a strong bleach solution to clean those. And they'll do that every several days or every week or so. And then the most aggressive is what they call a CIP, a clean in place. And that's when they take the racks offline. They add these chemicals like citric acid and the sodium hypochlorite and sodium hydroxide. There's just a cocktail of things that they'll put through there, and they'll do that maybe once a month. Early on in this process, when they were having some problems, they were trying to go on a once a month schedule, and they said, "Oh, it's not working." And they had to go through an aggressive schedule where they were doing that maybe once a week, and that would certainly increase all the chemical costs.
But each one of those units is going to be down for four or five hours.
That's right. Yeah, they schedule them, and when they do the CIPs, they'll. We have four racks of membranes with all these different modules with the membranes inside those. It takes about half a day, I think, to do a CIP on a rack. Assuming everything goes right, you run into problems that can take longer. But generally, they can get two racks done in a day, so it's about a four-day process to go through and do the strongest cleaning.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Questions?
Oh, I might make a comment. It's kind of interesting because in the Geological Society of America, they're working on the projections of the heating of the Earth, okay, and that the carbon dioxide that's being absorbed in seawater is changing, so that the acidity is increasing, and they're concerned about in the next 100 years. That there's not going to be that the sea is not going to have enough calcium carbonate for the shellfish, basically to be able to build their shells, and that's an interesting situation that's just the opposite of what you're trying to contend with here in the piping system, and it would just bring to mind, okay. Is anything changing within the lake and the chemistry of the lake that is going on due to the Earth's warming, et cetera, et cetera? You know, it becomes a very complex problem.
the waters we have here have always been pretty hard, and all along this coast, I think, and down in Santa Barbara and such, they can struggle with the same issues. It is interesting, and everything is connected to everything else, and CO2 has been here for a while, and if you go to places like the White Cliffs of Dover and such, you know, that's where all the carbon dioxide from, you know, millions of years ago has ended up. Mm-hmm. So keeps recycling itself.
So, Mr. Beaton, this project, as proposed, is within the bounds of the existing budget by delaying some other projects that are
that's
less.
That's my understanding. Yes, I think there was one item again with his estimates here. Is that if you endorse this, you proceed would proceed by moving some of these monies around. There was, I think, a final shortfall that they estimated $70,000 further into the project that we'd have to figure out how to pay for that. But again, that's $70,000 out of the $600,000 that they're looking at. So. But it would be addressed after the completion of the design and the preparation of the detailed cost estimates for the project. So.
All right. Any other comments or discussion?
I have just a question, Jim. I think it's already been answered, John, but you're recommending, or at least the group recommending the CO2 addition.
Yes.
And over 3.4, you're saying both CO2 and maybe a long-term pellets. I think you said that the reason you wouldn't do long-term pellets now, it just costs too blessed much to do. Is that what we're saying?
That's basically my understanding.
It'd be great to have it, but it just costs more than we can afford to have all the other benefits of CO2. I mean, of pellets. Yeah.
The pellets, I think, would be
got a whole long list of why it's great. So yes. I wonder why don't we do that? So, but the answer is we can't afford it, right?
Yes. That's correct.
Oh, all right. Then I just wanted to, if I heard that right.
All right. So if there is, how about from the audience? Do we have any? Yes, I see someone in the audience. And give us your name again, please. The newly appointed alternate delegate.
Yes, Ed Waggy from Pismo Beach, alternate. Just a couple questions. One is, did the TAC look at any impacts on the wastewater treatment plants or the home hot water systems?
No. The changes that we'd be making in the plant or to the pH water would not be terribly significant.
And right, this should be pretty small. But
pretty,
I'm just curious,
pretty small, but
especially home hot water tanks where you're heating the water, driving the CO2 out, raising the pH, and that could precipitate some additional scale out. Yeah. Seems to me
it would actually, I think, return the pH to maybe what I'd say is levels that we've seen historically.
All right.
One of the changes I hadn't mentioned, but in this new plant, we use sodium hypochlorite, a bleach solution,
right,
as a disinfectant. In years past, in the old plant, we used gaseous chlorine, which is also another form of chlorine.
Right.
The gaseous chlorine, when you add that to the water, it actually is acidic, and so it lowers the pH a little bit. Sodium hypochlorite does just the opposite. So I'd say that in general, in the past, the water has been more acidic than it is right now, than it's been in the last couple of years. So these adjustments we would make would return it to levels that we've historically had.
Okay. Yeah, I would think it'd be fairly minor any impacts downstream. I'm just curious.
But it absolutely is something we would have to keep in mind. Especially in, I don't know if any of the agencies down here have had lead and copper problems. The last thing we want to do is kind of exacerbate one of those problems. But if we kind of approach it stepwise and maybe make just enough to prevent as much of the scanner, slow it down significantly without going too far, I think it would sort of be the optimum.
Kind of a balancing act.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. Anybody else? Any other comments? So we are looking for a motion, I think, to approve the staff's recommendation with regard to the carbon dioxide project as described in the letter of January 7th, 2009.
I would so move, Mr. Chairman, to do that, to enhance the plant so that it work properly and not have so much cleaning. Since we've spent a lot of money out there, we'll keep it going as best we can.
Okay, thank you.
I'd second that.
So we got a motion and a second. And for your purpose, Mr. Beaton, do we need, is a voice vote sufficient, or would you like a roll call?
Maybe just best to go through a roll call just to be sure. Okay, Ms. Dean.
Yes.
Mr. Ehring.
Yes.
Mr. Gehring.
Yes.
Mr. Wallace.
Yes.
Mr. Reynolds.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One more here.
Ms. Bright.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you.
Any other comments on that item? And all right, then we're up to committee member comments. And I guess I'll entertain any comments, and maybe we can start with Ms. Steen. Or maybe Mr. Myers.
Well, I'm just glad to be here. I don't have other comments than that. I'm not official, but it's a learning process, and it was nice to be in on this tonight and hear what went on. Have you at least take my comments without getting mad at me, so that was a good start.
I have nothing right now.
I'm fine, thank you.
I have no comments. Thank you.
I just think that when we proceed with this spillway addition, that we want to be cautious if we do the right thing.
Okay. That's right.
I have no comments. Thank you.
And this is your last service on this committee for a while anyway, or not?
You just never know. I just show up at the oddest times, don't I?
All right. Well, thank you. And we'll hope to see you again.
Well, I always enjoy it, so I just never know when I'll be called into service, but I'll be ready to serve.
Aren't you still the alternate, though, Carrie?
No.
No, you're not?
No.
No, I think Miss Peterson is
right.
The alternate.
Oh, Peterson will be, yes.
Well, we'll miss you.
All right, before we adjourn, does anyone in the audience have anything they'd like to add? We are adjourned.